This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the lawyer who won Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court case that legalized abortion in 1973. Sarah Weddington was only 25 years old when she went before the Supreme Court. The right she won is in jeopardy, so abortion has remained her issue, although she says she wishes she could move on to something else. She spent much of the past decade traveling around the country, speaking on college campuses about abortion rights. Weddington has served in the Texas State Legislature and served in President Carter's administration. She's written a new memoir called A Question of Choice. In this book, she reveals that she had an abortion while she was in law school. I asked her why she kept her abortion a secret until now.
I'm a very private person. I'm an introvert. I don't like talking about personal things. And I always thought that I had really worked on this case for all women and to be sure that they were spared what I and millions of others knew. It was also that I thought my story was not as dramatic as many others because my boyfriend and soon-to-be husband went with me. We did end up with a good doctor. I didn't have any medical problems. And millions of women had terrible experiences. The reason I finally did go public now is because I think we can't save it in a court of law, and the usual legal arguments aren't working. And so it has to be an argument in the ballot box, in the court of public opinion. And I think there are many of us who've never told our stories. And what is so important is that abortion has been an issue. It is something a lot of women in this country have known, both illegal and legal. And maybe the way to save it is for us just to talk to our neighbors and our friends and people who like and respect us and share our personal experiences.
Did you think that it would hurt you if people found out that you had an abortion?
Well, I think if you look back at the time I went and had an abortion, which was my last year in law school, it was a time when I was very embarrassed to have been pregnant. That was something you just didn't do, especially not before marriage. I was disappointed with myself. It was one of those things I wanted to always be a secret. I don't feel so strongly about it today, but I do feel that part of the reason we fought the issue was for privacy. So people made decisions in private. They could carry them out in private. It wasn't something I thought women should always have to talk about. Unfortunately, we're just in a danger zone. The other thing was I didn't want every time I started talking about the legal aspects to get it totally off on that, and I thought the opponents would try to do that. And so the only reason I told it now is because I think we have to save it in the November election. And if we can save it then, it will have been well worth my time telling my story, and I think for others to tell theirs.
I'd like to hear a little bit more of your story. So you were in your last year of law school when you were pregnant. You were in a relationship with someone who you later married.
That's right, and who helped with the case.
And why didn't you want to have a baby at that point?
Well, I was working two jobs already, trying to put myself through law school. My daddy's a preacher. He was making $9,000 a year at the time. They had two younger children who were both in college. They were supporting them. I was supporting myself. Ron had come back from military service, and he was finishing undergraduate. He was just getting ready to start law school, and so we were looking at supporting ourselves for three more years. It was not a time that we felt we could really afford, support, have the time for a child at that point. And Ron had never really particularly wanted children anyway, and I had known that from the beginning of the relationship. And there were a variety of reasons, as I think there always are.
Did you have girlfriends, or did you know other young women who had become pregnant when they didn't want to, had the baby, and had their lives changed in ways that they didn't want?
Well, I certainly knew some women in high school, a couple in college. In fact, there had been one woman who had become pregnant our first year in law school, one of five, and who had dropped out of law school. And so I had known those women who had gone through the pregnancy and seen how they usually had to drop out and how the future they thought was theirs was very much diminished as a consequence. I frankly don't think I knew anyone who had had an abortion. I mean, I did, but I didn't know anybody. I didn't know that they had. It wasn't anything anyone had ever talked to me about. And so for me to go to Mexico, I didn't speak Spanish. I was absolutely petrified about it. But I was also determined that I was going to finish law school. I was going to help Ron finish law school. And we were going to establish a wider world for ourselves than women had traditionally known. And I saw pregnancy at that point as something that had tethered women to a very limited future.
Yeah, you had your abortion in Mexico. The law in Texas at the time, I believe, said that abortion would only be allowed if it would save the life of the woman.
That's right. It was the only reason. So rape, incest, those were not justifications. Anything having to do with health or economics or nothing except to save the life of the woman.
How come you didn't have an illegal abortion in Texas? You probably could have found a doctor willing to do it.
You know, the only thing is that Ron was the one who went to find a name of some place to go, and the name he came up with was the doctor in Mexico, and a couple of people that he knew said that they knew people who had been there and had had good experiences and that it was safe. And so, frankly, it's probably just the luck of the draw in terms of the name we happened to come up with. Now I know there were people doing abortions illegally in Texas, but we didn't find those names, and there was no central place to find a name.
As a law student at the time, was it a crisis for you to do something that you knew was breaking the law?
No, I can't. I mean, it was really scary. It was I was petrified to find myself in that situation. But I was so determined that I would have done anything to escape the law in Texas.
So you had a good physical recovery?
No problems. I was back in class on Monday.
Emotional impact on your life?
You know, I know it would make a better story if I could say it had a major impact, but it didn't. I think that most women really go through a process of thinking through the options. They choose the one that they feel is best for them. I am very glad I went through that. I think having finished law school and the options that were open to me as a woman with that education, to be able to do the things I have to help save millions of other women, that is such a positive feedback in my life that it's kind of like being married. I'm glad I was married. I'm not sorry I was divorced. Obviously, you think about it some, but I would do it over again.
In your memoir, you say that you didn't think you were the right person to argue abortion rights before the Supreme Court. Why?
Well, it was my first contested case.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, I look back now, and of course, when I got out of law school, I couldn't get a job. It was 1967. The firms in Texas weren't ready to hire women. And so I ended up doing research for a professor. And when these women said, you know, would you help us look into this, I had some extra time. Ron was in law school. I was working at the law school. So I had the library right there. But essentially, I said, well, you know, I think you really need somebody older, somebody with more experience. And they said, well, first, you're the only person we've come up with who's willing to do it for free. And we think it ought to be a woman attorney. You're the only woman attorney we know. And then UT Law School really does train people in how to think about law, not so much where the courthouse is, but how to think about it. And so it wasn't that I was the best choice. It was just I was willing to do it and cared a great deal about the issue.
How did you find Norma McCorvey, the woman who became known as Jane Roe in the case, the plaintiff?
Well, because I had not done any other contested cases, I had done uncontested divorces, a few wills for people with no money, and an adoption for a relative, I knew I needed some help. And of the five women who started in my class in 1965, one of them was Linda Coffey, and she had graduated and gone to work for a federal judge. So I thought she would know something about federal procedures, and she would have seen more trials. So I called Linda. She said she would be co-counsel, and originally we thought the women in Austin would be plaintiffs, but none of them were pregnant, or those who were able to make a responsible decision early to move on, to have the abortion, have the child. They didn't turn out to be the plaintiff. And so first we found a married couple in Dallas that she had a neurochemical disorder. The doctor said, don't get pregnant, don't take the pill, and they were saying, as a married couple, this puts us in a terrible quandary. So first, we were doing the case with them, and then Jane Roe went to a male attorney in Dallas, said, I'm pregnant, I don't want to be, I want an abortion. He said, I do adoption work, but if you think you really are adamant about an abortion, I know two young women who are looking for a case for a plaintiff, and why don't you go see them? And by that point, we were having the legal papers pretty much ready to go, had a few things we still had to look up. And she said, well, what would it entail for me? And we said, well, no money. We're raising that. We're donating time. Not much time at all. She did end up signing a one-page legal affidavit, but never went to any of the court proceedings, no depositions, no interrogatories. And we said, you can be anonymous. So she was willing to do it in part because her personal involvement was so minimal. And that was because she was, in essence, a figurehead for all of those women. It was a class action on behalf of all women who were or might become pregnant and want to consider all options.
Did you think that she was the right figurehead, or didn't it matter?
Well, I didn't know it was a U.S. Supreme Court case. I would have, if I knew then what I know now, I would have been much more careful in picking a plaintiff. But at the time, I thought some of the things about her were good. For example, she had dropped out of school, never finished high school. She had run away from home very early. She had already had a child. Her mother took it away from her on the basis she was unfit to raise a child. And so I thought there were a lot of sympathetic factors in her fact situation. But we always thought of it as a case that was for lots of women, not just for one. And I frankly thought some other case would get to the Supreme Court, the New York case, the New Jersey case, the Illinois case. There were cases just springing up all over the country. And so I assumed that we were doing the Texas case, and we were adding to the momentum of legal ferment, of legal work that would someday lead to some case getting to the Supreme Court. It never occurred to me when we filed Roe versus Wade that this would become the Supreme Court vehicle.
In your argument, you never mentioned how Jane Roe got pregnant, and you later learned that she had lied in some press interviews and said that she was raped when she actually wasn't. Do you know why she lied?
No, and I've never asked her that. When she first came to us, she said, would it help if I'd been raped? And we said no. There was no exception in the Texas law for rape. It made no difference. And we did ask her if there were any police reports, any interviews, anything that we could prove that she had been raped, and she said no. So to us, the issue was not, how did you get pregnant? We thought that was a totally irrelevant legal issue.
And that's why you left it out.
And that's why we left it out, because we also didn't want to focus on an issue of rape. We didn't want to say anything to the court we couldn't prove. And it was actually 6 months after the decision in the June 1973 Good Housekeeping. And when I got it, I wasn't there when the writer interviewed her because she lived in Dallas. I was in Austin. And so I got that article when it came out, and I started reading all this stuff about the rape, and I was just incredulous about it. But I didn't know if it was true or not. And for many years, I didn't know if it was true or not. Her story got bigger as the years went by. And finally, in 1989, Carl Rowan interviewed her just a couple of days before the Bork nomination. We were working so hard on trying to beat that. And he said to her, what about the rape? And she said, I lied.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Sarah Weddington. She's the lawyer who argued and won the Roe v. Wade decision in the Supreme Court, the decision that legalized abortion. She's written a new book called A Question of Choice. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is lawyer Sarah Weddington, who won the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in 1973. You didn't think that your test case would be the case that made it to the Supreme Court. How did your case get to be the one?
Well, it was a period when all the lawyers in these cases were sharing information. Harriet Pilpel, who was the New York lawyer for Planned Parenthood, was marvelously helpful. And so it was kind of like a synthesis of good legal thought and talent around the country coming to a consensus about how to present the case. In this case, of course, I picked up on the Griswold versus Connecticut case from 1965, which Harriet had been very involved in. That was the case where Connecticut had made the use of birth control illegal. If you were married or single, made no difference. Using birth control was a criminal offense. And a woman named Estelle Griswold, who was the director of the Planned Parenthood in New Haven, gave a contraceptive device to a married couple, was arrested, convicted, fined. She appealed it to the Supreme Court, and the court had said there is a right of privacy to decide whether to bear or begat a child. It was the best specific language we had from a Supreme Court case. And so we took that line of privacy as being our basic focus, and then also how fundamental pregnancy is for women, because the Supreme Court will usually not overturn a state statute unless it's really very personal, very basic. And so we were saying we think nothing affects a woman's life more than the number and spacing of her children. And then the state of Texas was saying, oh, but we have a right to pass these laws to protect potential unborn life. And we were saying, well, you haven't treated the fetus like a person in any other situation. You can't pick out this one situation that interferes with liberty for women and say, suddenly, here we're going to do it.
Explain a little bit more. Why did your case become the case that was argued before the Supreme Court of all the test cases that were out there?
Terry, I think it was a couple of things. One, there had been a prior case where they did not appeal. There was one where the wrong party appealed. And the thought was that the Supreme Court was looking for a case, actually two cases, that would be representative of all the different laws around the country, and therefore, by deciding those cases, the court could essentially decide the law pertaining to states all over, and therefore, they wouldn't have to deal with other cases. So they chose the Texas case, which was the very restrictive law, as we've already said. And then they also took a case from Georgia, which was a state that had a law that about 13 or so states had, which we then called the liberalized law. It was a law that said abortion is lawful for rape, incest, fetal deformity to save the life or health of the woman, but she has to go through a lot of hoops in order to get there. But with the Texas and the Georgia case combined, the court had before it representative cases of most of the states and their laws at that time.
I want to get back to your argument. You had expanded the part of your brief on why the fetus is not a person, and you argued that legal rights begin at birth. Why did you decide to expand the part of the brief on why a fetus is not a person?
Well, we thought that that was crucial because the state was arguing that its right to regulate was to protect the fetus. And yet, the more we tried to research the legal status of the fetus, it clearly didn't support what the state was saying. For example, the Constitution says all persons born or naturalized are citizens. It is under law. We've always taken a census, but we don't count pregnant women twice. Pregnant women who leave the country don't get two passports. You get a tax deduction for the year a child is born. In Texas, murder was the killing of one who has been born. Rights of inheritance were contingent on being born alive. And so while I was personally uneasy and thought the court would be with the later stage of pregnancy, when I tried to look for legal hooks, birth had always been the determining moment. And so that's why I ended up arguing to the court that based on our legal history, birth was the moment at which legal rights attached. The court instead said there's a trimester approach. It was dictum. It was advisory. It wasn't part of the opinion. But the court clearly said to the states, now, if you want to prohibit abortion in third trimester, you can, except to save the life or perhaps extreme health of the woman.
You know, this trimester part of the decision really surprised you. You say that it's very rare for the judges to include a concept that wasn't argued in the case.
Exactly. You see, I had never heard of the trimester approach. It was not in the briefs. It was not in the oral arguments. And the first time I ever saw it was when I read the opinion. Now, some books written have said that Blackmun was spending time at the Mayo Clinic before the opinion was written, and I know that part's true. But some books have said that Blackmun was talking to some doctors and they made that a suggestion. Other people who have heard Blackmun talk about the issue have said it was a concept original to him and one that he put into the opinion. I don't know which the true story is, but I think the court's idea was that there was going to be still a lot of state legislation, that if they gave the state some guidance about what they thought was within constitutional boundaries and what wasn't, it would just save time and the court wouldn't have to be dealing with the issue time and time again. Of course, that feeling, if I'm accurate about the court's perception, turned out to be very inaccurate.
Did you think that the anti-abortion activists would mobilize right away and keep it up for as long as they have?
No, I really underestimated that. I knew that they would be very upset by the decision. I knew they would try to undermine it. But what I did not foresee was the changes in the makeup of the Supreme Court. So through the years of the 70s, the battles we fought, the skirmishes, were over a constitutional amendment that those opposed to abortion were trying to make abortion illegal, unavailable. We fought skirmishes about whether there would be funding for women who were otherwise eligible for federal medical services. We fought a number of what I call sort of side battles. But then in 1980, that seesaw started to turn, to move. Before Roe versus Wade, before the decision, clearly those who were pro-choice were on the ascendancy and I think peaked with Roe versus Wade. And then the opposition began to mobilize and they began to move on that seesaw. And I think the peak came in 1989 with the Webster decision. But it started moving when Reagan was elected and started appointing judges who had a far different concept of Roe versus Wade and privacy. So that the Webster case in 1989 was the top of the momentum for those who were anti-choice, because at that point, those people who were pro-choice suddenly said, you know, I don't think we can take this for granted much longer. Look at what's happening with the court. And so people began to join pro-choice organizations, to pay more attention to the issue. That was accelerated with the Casey, Pennsylvania case this last few months.
And just to clarify, the Webster decision to which you referred is the 1989 decision by the Supreme Court that ruled a state could prohibit the use of public buildings and public employees from performing abortions.
That's right.
Do you ever wish that you were back in court arguing one of the abortion test cases?
No, because I think there are other people who are best able to do those now, who have the full-time resources and the backup staffs to really do it well. And frankly, I think your chances of winning today are much less than they were before. I was very fortunate to go before the Supreme Court when there were the judges on the court that you had a good chance of winning. Now I think the legal action is often like a rear guard action. It's an action to keep further erosion from happening, but it's not where we're making big progress.
Sarah Weddington is the lawyer who won Roe versus Wade, the case that guaranteed a woman's right to abortion. She's written a new memoir called A Question of Choice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.